When I was a boy, helping to inhabit that little Missouri town, my comrades and I had one permanent ambition to be a steamboatman. Boy after boy managed to go on the river, and by and by I ran away too. I said I would never come home again till I was a pilot and could come in glory. I loved that profession. Far better than any I've followed since. I took a measureless pride in it. For a pilot on a steamboat in those days was the only unfettered and entirely independent human being that walked on the earth. The pilot house was a sumptuous glass temple offering a princely view of the great Mississippi, rolling its mile-wide tide along, shining in the sun. On the 4 o'clock watch mornings, I could see the summer sunrise on the river. That was enchanting. First, the eloquence of silence. Then the haunting sense of loneliness, isolation, remoteness from the worry and bustle of the world. The dawn creeps in stealthily. Solid walls of black forest soften to gray, and vast stretches of the river open up and reveal themselves. The water's glass smooth. Then a bird pipes up. And when the light has become a little stronger, you have one of the fairest and softest pictures imaginable. You have the intense green of the massed and crowded foliage nearby, and you see it paling, shade by shade in front of you. And all this stretch of river is a mirror. Well, that's all beautiful. But when the sun gets well up and distributes a pink flush here and a powder of gold yonder and a purple haze where it will yield the best effect, you grant that you've seen something that is worth remembering.
That was Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain. We're talking about Mark Twain tonight. It's Sonoma County Reads Month, and you'll hear a lot about the Big Read. And the book chosen for Sonoma County Reads is Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. Jonah Raskin, whose article on books about Mark Twain was published in The Chronicle last month. And Jonah will be talking about Samuel Clemens, whom we know by the more familiar name of Mark Twain. During the second half of the show, we're featuring a stellar lineup of young poets who will be reading their work and other work. This program is part of California Poets in the Schools, and I think you'll just be so pleased to hear what they've accomplished. So stay tuned. It's a novel idea. Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and my guest in the studio is Jonah Raskin. Jonah is chairman of communication studies at Sonoma State University. And Jonah, you are no stranger to the KRCB audience.
Thank you for inviting me here.
It's so good to have you here. The last time you were here, you were talking about your wonderful book, Field Days.
Oh, yes, right. So I don't think there's a connection, or at least I don't know of a connection between Mark Twain and Field Days.
So far as we know, he never was a field worker. Yes, he was rich. He was poor. He was a businessman. He was a gambler. He was a miner. He was a. It's hard to think of anything except a field hand that he didn't take up during his long life.
Yeah, right. Yes, like absolutely to do what he did. The only person I know who tried to out Mark Twain was Jack London.
Oh, there's a thought.
He read Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. And he, when some of his earliest stories, when Jack London, he was still in high school in Oakland, he did some imitation Mark Twain stories that were published in the high school magazine.
Amazing.
And where he's using dialect, you know, because Mark Twain did use the sort of southern dialect. He had a really good ear.
Yes.
And he sort of knew, like, black English and slang and yeah, he was a great ventriloquist and had his ear to the ground. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was literally, but he did really listen. Wherever he was, he listened to the speech of people and could certainly satirize, like, the way people spoke. So there was Jack London. Writing or doing his best to write like Mark Twain, and also went to Hannibal, where Mark Twain was from, and then went down the Mississippi River on a raft, where he was trying to be like Huckleberry
Jack
Finn.
Jack London did. Amazing.
Yes. So Mark Twain was, he was a pretty radical guy in his time.
He was.
In a lot of ways, he was more admirable than Jack London, because Jack London liked the United States going overseas and conquering the Philippines and Puerto Rico. Mark Twain didn't like that kind of aggressive foreign policy. He was part of what was called the Anti-Imperialist League.
Yes, and he'd actually been a soldier for, what, a couple of weeks? I mean, that's an amazing story of how he joined the army and didn't care for it.
In the Civil War, yes.
And I guess it was easier to get out of the army in those days.
Right.
Essentially, you walked away. Yeah.
One of the most interesting things to me about Mark Twain is the role of race. I mean, there's so much about race in his writing.
And so glad you brought that up.
If there is one book of Mark Twain's that I go back to, it's definitely The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Yeah. I think that boys are notorious for not wanting to read.
Yes.
And they say that boys will read more if they can read about boys.
Yes.
And boys who have adventures.
Yes.
And then, of course, the problem to some people with Huckleberry Finn is that the N-word is
used there. It is the language. And we just don't seem to be able to figure out how to handle that.
So I was just saying, like, Huckleberry Finn, we have this friendship between this poor white boy and this escaped slave. Huck is the poor white boy, and then Jim, who's the escaped slave.
That's right.
And there's some real differences between them. And Huck has grown up with a lot of prejudices.
That's right.
But he does really come to see and to appreciate Jim. And Jim is like maybe the best father figure that he has, because his own father is just so reprehensible.
Yes. Yeah. Have you been to Hannibal, Missouri?
No, I am not.
Yeah, I remember stopping there once, and the overall impression that one has there is of the river.
Yes.
Because I was thinking that if he'd been inland 100 miles, his life would have been so different.
Yes.
But here, you know, out in the middle of the country, with this enormous river constantly flowing by, you know, and I read that he almost drowned any number of times because he spent so much time in the river. And then, of course, being a river pilot, the river, maybe that's where the movement in his life came in. Maybe that's why he was a constant traveler.
I think that's a really good insight. Yes, this flow, the sense of change and the bigness of the Mississippi, and it
power.
Definitely...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. He was in large part the person he was because of the Mississippi River and spending so much time there and the rhythms of the river. And he wrote beautifully about it. And the Mississippi is like a character.
Yes.
In his books.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that boys particularly like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. In your article in the Chronicle, you mentioned that he was, let's see if I can find the quote, most ardent admirers of Mark Twain are white American men. And then you had a quote from Faulkner. He's the first truly American writer. I don't know if that quote was from your article or somewhere else. And then Russell Banks said about Mark Twain, he makes possible an American literature which would otherwise not have been possible.
People make these really exaggerated claims.
And Hemingway.
Yes, all of American literature goes back to Huckleberry Finn.
That's right.
Maybe earlier generations like saw him such newness and freshness about him.
Yes.
Yes, if you would have read Twain in 1890 or 1900, or because like so much for so long, our national literature was under the spell of the English and influenced by the English. And
that's right.
I mean, Hawthorne and then Henry James going to England and T.S. Eliot. Well, that's a little bit later, but going to England. And Twain was just so thoroughly American and had American speech. And, you know, he does satirize Americans.
Oh, he does. He's a wicked satirist. he's wicked, but he's not mean. And he's so clever that some of them probably didn't even realize they were being satirized.
Yes. I don't think I really understood or knew, appreciated satire until I read, I think it was F. Scott Fitzgerald, the man who wrote The Great Gatsby about satire, that satire, in order to satirize something well, to do it right, you really do have to, there's love in there. You care enough about these people, the people that you're satirizing. I think it is out of affection. I was thinking about the Mark Twain story. I think the first story that made him well known or famous was the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which he wrote when he was in California, and certainly widely read in his own time. And I think he did love these tellers of tall tales.
Oh yes, and they were kind of fashionable at that time. Artemus Ward and some of the other humorists of the day.
Yes. And you're saying Twain was so witty. It almost seems like every time he opened his mouth, he said something that was memorable.
Yes.
He couldn't not be creative with words or language.
Yes.
So that's really delightful about him. Yes.
And some of the things that we think he said, he might not actually have said. And you said you got some feedback from
In one of the books that I reviewed is about Mark Twain's secretary near the end of his life and their relationship, this stormy relationship. And
yes, she wanted to be the next Mrs. Twain.
Yes. But probably if he actually did marry her, she probably would have regretted it. I think it was tough to be married to Mark Twain.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Libby was a saint, wasn't she?
Yes. In the book, the author reprints an advertisement for cigars. It has a picture of Mark Twain. It's Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. It has his name. And then it says, a woman is only a woman, but a cigar is a smoke.
Yes.
Well, I didn't check it. Somebody emailed into the editor of the Chronicle and said, is this – I think it's Rudyard Kipling, he said, but maybe it's Sigmund Freud. So we haven't said anything yet about the fact that he was born Samuel Clemens.
That's
and that
right.
Mark Twain is his pen name.
That's right.
Which is just a stroke of genius to take Mark Twain as a pen name. And there does seem to be a basic duality in this man.
Yes.
That is nicely symbolized, shall we say, by the fact that he has these two names.
Did we know why he wanted a pen name?
I'm not sure.
I mean, Samuel Clemens has a nice ring to it. But he was trying out different names, and a lot of them were silly.
Right, yes. Thomas Jefferson Snodgrass.
That's right. Thank goodness he didn't go with that.
That one I don't think would have flown.
No.
Well, I think that he just, in order to, he was definitely always wanting to flap his wings and soar and get up there in a way. And sort of Mark Twain really enabled him to do that. So in the book that's about his early years, it's called Lighting Out for the Territory.
Yes.
That's about where he with his older brother went west.
That trip west in a stagecoach, because the railroad didn't yet go. I mean, the story of that, that must be in Roughing It, where he tells about his trip west.
Yes.
What a ghastly trip. And, of course, he's making jokes the whole way.
Well, he did say it was roughing it.
Yes, that's true.
In Lighting Out for the Territory, the author does reprint, and that's accurate. He reprints the first article in which Samuel Clemens used the Mark Twain byline or pen name.
Yes.
He says he feels like he's waking up from a long sleep.
Amazing.
So taking the name, it's sort of like a second birth.
Yes.
Like being able to look back at his life and he's becoming another person and recreating himself. So there's the Mark Twain's body of work, which is really impressive. And then there's the fact that he's kind of like the artist of his own life. His life has so much drama in it.
When he was in Nevada in mining and the conditions were so primitive, and then when he went over the mountains to California and fell in love with San Francisco and went from a very uncomfortable place to what he considered paradise. He loved San Francisco.
I mean, he had to go west because, I mean, America was going west. It had been going west for a long time, but the Civil War was over. The North-South dynamic was such a main thing in the Civil War, and then I think it more turned to East and West.
Yes.
And so many Americans were going West, and everybody hearing this program knows that gold was discovered in California and that the whole world came to California. Thousands of people from every single country in the world came to California to make their fortunes. And so San Francisco was the first real cosmopolitan city. Yeah, so Twain he wanted to be where the action was. All kinds of writers went west. And Twain was, as you said, he did really love San Francisco. And I believe the Occidental Hotel was a place he was staying. And I think it's an accurate quotation where he said it was like heaven on the half shell.
Oh.
So, yes.
And then he kept on going west. He went to Hawaii.
Yes, right.
He wanted to see everything and do everything.
Right.
Uh-huh. And he was a speculator. He wasn't prudent, didn't have much money sense. When he had money, he spent it. When he didn't have money, he spent it. He liked to live well.
He did. Yes, he definitely did. And it does seem like he was just a very... I was going to say impeccable dresser.
Oh, yes, all those white suits. I read somewhere that at one time he had 17 white suits. Maybe that's a detail that you had.
Well, that's in one of the books.
In
17
books,
white suits.
That's right.
Quite a lot of suits. Yeah. So, yes, he continued going west and going to Hawaii, and he did go all over the world following the equator. And a travel writer and very curious about all different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And he's got that late story about King Leopold in the Congo.
Yes. Let's talk about that. I was so interested in Adam Hochschild's book.
Yes.
Called King Leopold's Ghost, when he talks about how he came to be acquainted with the story of King Leopold through reading Mark Twain. And, of course, the fact that Hochschild lives in San Francisco makes that another interesting connection. What a good thing that Mark Twain took up this cause late in his life and went on a speaking tour with Booker T. Washington. We think of the many different facets. You know, his first really famous story, the celebrated Jumping Frog. Well, from there to appearing with Booker T. Washington talking about the crimes of Belgium in the Congo.
Yes.
That's an enormous leap.
Yes. Mark Twain put his money where his mouth was.
That's
he really did live these values. And,
yes. And when he was a youngster, he had friends who were slaves or children of slaves. And it gradually dawned on him the evils of slavery.
Yes.
And
right.
when he saw the cruelty... and saw with his own eyes the cruelty and the barbarity of slavery. You can watch the development of his conscience about it as you read the different books. And it's marvelous to see. People can change. I mean, people can grow and learn from what they see and become a spokesman for the lessons that they've learned, don't you think?
Just makes me think that you know, Huckleberry Finn does also. Yes. He changes.
That's
and
right.
He grows. And
that's right.
And I would bet that Mark Twain himself changed in sort of writing the book because,
yes,
as you said, there as a child, a young person, he didn't really think that slavery was bad.
That's right.
As an institution, but he did really have close human connections to African Americans.
And that scene in Huck Finn when Huck is debating whether it's his moral duty to turn in Jim, and you see him trying to find the moral authority in that. And then you just hold your breath through that whole thing. And then finally, he realizes that he can't do that to Jim.
Right. Yeah, we're talking about like Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. And I think that most people would say that Huck Finn was like a bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Sawyer was supposed to be the good boy.
Mm-hmm.
But but the bad boy is sort of really more principled and his values mm-hmm. are gooder than mm-hmm. the supposed good boy. Like, mm-hmm. yes.
Tom. And he's wiser, more wise.
Yes, yes. So,
you know, Jonah, I
yes.
think sometimes people have a one-dimensional view of Mark Twain. I remember in grade
yeah.
school reading The Celebrated Jumping Frog and thinking, well, that's a cute story, but so what? And then some of us in grade school read Tom Sawyer, and in those days we read Huck Finn.
Yes.
And now we've read Mark Twain. We haven't even started reading Mark Twain if we stop with those books. Do you see a kind of a duality or maybe more than duality? What's the word for many-faceted?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, a very multifaceted person and very hopeful and positive and celebratory about life and at the same time really seeing, the goodness of the human heart. I think,
oh, yes.
you know, all great writers are, they're writing about the human heart.
Yes.
And so I think that Twain yes. is like a really very wonderful explorer of all the dimensions of the human heart and mm-hmm. sees the kind of depravity of the human yes. heart and the sort of viciousness and meanness of people. You know, coming back to Huckleberry Finn, but
yes.
where Huck like leaves the raft in the river, where he does have in many ways a very ideal kind of life with Jim,
yes.
and then he meets the people who are living along the river,
yes.
and they're bigoted, and they're these sort of mobs, and he was living, Mark Twain, we've talked some about his wanting to get rich and make money, and he was living in a time when people were making these great fortunes, and he wrote about the Gilded Age, and yes, really so insightful about this American fascination or drive for wealth and technology there. I mean,
oh,
he's
yes.
also really saw like all the problems about technology and machinery and in the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's
That's
court,
right.
right? The sort of clash.
Mm-hmm. And
there.
Of course, one of the reasons that he was investing in this machine printing was that he saw the possibilities of getting the books out, to being able to inexpensively print large numbers of books. He was just ahead of his time.
Yeah, right. Well, the printing press had definitely been good to him, and
yes.
he'd worked with newspapers and books. And so, there's, you know, I would say, yes, the anniversary of Mark Twain's death does give all of us and our whole culture this opportunity to look again at the richness and this sort of multidimensional writer who mm-hmm. does seem like he's bigger than life. And
if you were going to suggest to people who are intrigued by the thought of beyond Mark Twain and Huck Finn, what would you suggest as Mark Twain books that would be easily accessible?
Well, yeah, I would say, you know, why not read The Celebrated Jumping Frog?
Yeah.
That's just wonderful that he just wrote this. There are human characters, but also the story that has a frog in it.
It's very funny. And it, yes. It stays funny.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, he does have this travel writing. Yes. The Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. I do really like that. I think that's really good. I mean, he wrote, he was writing like a man of fire when he was in San Francisco. He just wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of pieces. And I know that he wrote about the Chinese in San Francisco. And he saw that there was some, racial prejudice against the Chinese, and he was like, that disturbed him. And King Leopold's soliloquy, really about the end of his life, of like, he did become really dark and bitter. You know, there's a collection that's called Mark Twain in Eruption. He like just was so irrepressible. And
the sadness in his life at that time, that having lost his beloved wife and two of his daughters.
Yes, the loss of his daughters.
Oh, the
there.
Grief was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you have loved to hear him lecture?
There is a short film clip of him, but there is no audio tape. Mm-hmm. If there was one, you would play it here on the air.
Of course. And I think we all feel that having, Hal Holbrook filled such an important niche, thereby devoting so many years to the interpretation.
He's still doing it. Hal Holbrook is still doing it. So that would be, since we can't hear Mark Twain himself, we could hear Hal Holbrook.
Yeah.
And I know that Hal Holbrook really did his homework and studied Mark Twain and did research. So,
Of all the authors that we've talked about, I think Mark Twain is one I would most like to have known. I mean, his warm and generous heart and his passion for justice and his wit and his love for his family, his wife.
Yeah,
he
would have kept you entertained. I think I forgot to say that while Jack London was making a lot of money, but he was also going around talking about socialism and revolution.
Yes.
And taking that people who had nothing should take away from people who had lots. And Mark Twain said, you better watch out, Jack, because people might come up to Glen Ellen and take away some of your property. But he said it in a very nice kind of way.
Yeah.
But he was pointing out to Jack London that maybe his ideals about equality would clash with his actual lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's wonderful to think of those two titans of literature.
Well, they were alive.
Yes.
They were in the United States together for some time. And Jack London was born the same year that the book Tom Sawyer was published in 1876, which is the isn't the American Centennial? 1776, 1876. Right. So. Right. Very, very, very American, and so American, what it means to be American is just, it's not one thing. There's a lot of different things, and it means African Americans as well as Yankees, and it means like these frontiersmen in Calaveras County and Chinese and the sort of really richness and Mississippi pilots and life on the shore and life on the river and the sense of things constantly changing.
And to think that he lived it all and wrote about it and left it for us. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Jonah, it's such a pleasure to talk with you. I just really look forward to finding books that we can talk about together. And you're so generous with your time to come in and share your knowledge.
Thank you for inviting me. So,
So, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and we've been listening to Jonah Raskin talking about Mark Twain, whose book Tom Sawyer is the subject of this year's Sonoma County Reads. During the break, you can hear Hal Holbrook again with some more Mark Twain. And when we come back, we'll bring you California Poets in the Schools, young people from local schools reading from their work and from other poetry. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to present you a man whose great learning and veneration for truth are only exceeded by his high moral character and majestic presence. I refer in these vague general terms to myself. I consider introductions unnecessary, but if it's the custom to have them, I prefer to do the act myself. Suppose I can rely on getting in all the facts. I was born modest, but it wore off. I was once presented to an audience by a lawyer who kept his hands in his pockets. He introduced me as Mark Twain, a humorist who is really funny. A very rare creature indeed. Why, I was struck speechless by this complimentary thunderbolt. I'd scarcely in my lifetime listened to a compliment so beautifully phrased. Or so well deserved. But we had a much rarer creature in our midst than a humorist who was really funny. We had a lawyer who kept his hands in his own pockets. Oh, but I do like compliments. Why, we all do. Humorists, burglars, congressmen, all of us in the trade. The plan of the newspaper is good. If you can't get a compliment any other way, pay yourself one. I do that often. I can do it right now. I can state at this moment that there are two men who are most remarkable. Kipling is one, and I am the other one. Between us, we cover all knowledge. He knows all that can be known, and I know the rest. I have a compliment from a little Montana girl which came to me indirectly. She was in a room in which was a large photograph of me on the wall, and after gazing at it steadily for a time, she said, "We've got a picture of John the Baptist, too." And she said, "Only ours got more trimmings." I suppose she meant the halo.
All right, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester. And before we ask the young poets to read, we're going to hear from Phyllis Meshlin, who is the area coordinator for the program California Poets in the Schools. Here's Phyllis.
Well, it's one of the oldest and largest artist-in-residency programs in the whole country. And we have about 150 poet teachers who work with many thousands of children every year. And every year we put out an anthology, and for our 45th anniversary, we wanted to do a really special one. So it's a bigger than usual anthology this year, and it's just beautiful and full of unbelievable poems. I think this program is such a gift to get that voice out there and get kids more aware of what they have to offer. And by the way, we work with classroom teachers. I am eternally impressed at the dedication, the sense of humor, the love that they put into their jobs. We help students throughout California to recognize and celebrate their own creativity, intuition, and intellectual curiosity through the creative writing process. Our multicultural community of poet teachers bring their experience and love for their craft into the classroom every single day. So in celebration of 45 years, we have a party coming up. It's going to be on April 17th from 3 to 5 in the afternoon at the Central Library, the Forum Room, 3rd and E Streets in Santa Rosa. It's free. It's open to the public. We're going to welcome our new poet laureate, Gwen O'Gara, who is also a dedicated and veteran poet teacher. We will have music. We will have poetry out loud performers, and I will tell you a little more about that in a minute, and you're going to hear some of them. We will have munchies, And we're going to have a little open mic for alumni of the program. So I did want to say something about Poetry Out Loud. So for the last 4 years, we have had the opportunity in this county and for 5 or 6 years in the state capitals to get high school students to learn to recite excellent poems written in the English language. There's currently at poetryoutloud.org a 700-poem anthology, and from those poems, the kids choose poems that they dearly love, that speak to them, memorize them, which is learning by heart, taking it into their bodies, taking it into their heart, and putting it out there for the world to see. And we had an unbelievable field of competitors this year. So I want to be sure to give you the website. California Poets in the Schools is cpits.org. Both these organizations need our support. We'd love to have people join us as members and find any way you can possibly to support. You can also buy past editions of the anthology online, and you'll be able to do that at the festival, too.
Next, we're going to hear from Iris Dunkel, who's one of the poet teachers. Iris worked with Sierra Downey at Casa Grande High School in Petaluma on poetry reading. And we're going to hear Sierra read Pleasures by Denise Levertov. But first, Iris Dunkel.
Yes, I had the great opportunity to coach Sierra Downing, and we had wonderful time getting to close read these extraordinary poems and talk through how she understood them and how she really connected with them. And I just couldn't believe how spectacularly she could listen to someone giving her feedback about a poem and just blossom into a performance about it. And it was just a wonderful collaboration is what I would call it. She really connected with these poems. And I saw her perform one of the poems the first time. She did it in front of the class when, you know, we were just before she had won the school competition. And I was like, oh, she gets that immediately. Once I came back and saw that she was winner, I was very impressed and I was not surprised.
My name is Sierra Downey. I am 16. I was in a poetry competition at my school in Casa Grande because my teacher, Miss Gardner, had us do a class assignment in which we had to memorize a poem from the Poetry Out Loud website. I won the class competition, and then I went on to the school competition, and then I went on to the Poetry Out Loud countywide competition. When I talked with my poetry coach, Iris Dunkel, she helped me see the style that this next poet had. The poem is actually Pleasures by Denise Levertov. And so we discussed how she emulated other styles of American poets and how she used very almost simple symbolism to represent very potent and very sensual ideas. Pleasures by Denise Levertov. I like to find what's not found at once, but lies within something of another nature, in repose, distinct. Gull feathers of glass hidden in white pulp, the bones of squid, which I pull out and lay, blade by blade, on the draining board, tapered as if for swiftness, to pierce the heart, but fragile. Substance belying design, or a fruit, mame, cased in rough brown peel, the flesh rose amber, and the seed a stone of wood, carved and polished, walnut-colored, formed like a Brazil nut, but large, large enough to fill the hungry palm of a hand. I like the juicy stem of grass that grows within the coarser leaf folded round, and the butter-yellow glow in the narrow flute from which the morning glory opens blue and cool on a hot morning.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Pamela Singer Yesbick and B. Moody. Pamela has been a poet teacher with California Poets in the Schools, and she and her student worked together on a poem. They'll talk about their experience of working together, and then they'll read the poem.
My name is Pamela Singer Yesbick, and I've been teaching through California Poets in the Schools for about 30 years.
I'm B. Moody, and Pamela is my poetry teacher. When I first wrote my first poem, I was excited. I felt like it was really me, and like it was just different. I really liked it and just kept writing and writing, and I don't stop.
She's a real author. She's one of my most talented students ever, and she loves nature, and it's just a real refreshing student to work with because she's so in tune with nature. She's really a beautiful writer. She hardly has to make any effort. Bea and I actually did this last summer together, and Bea would write one verse, and then I would pick up from there on the second verse, and I guess we have 5 or 6 verses. B would write a verse, I would write a verse, and we just tried to make it a cohesive poem.
Something special. What sky holds, the sky's filled with spirit's thunder. Rain for cry, wind for yawning and yelling. What sky holds is something special.
What sea holds, the sky is filled with spirit's light. Waves for eyes, storms for wisdom. What sea holds is something special.
The thing they hold is nature. Animals with people in them, just watching over you.
The owl's feather, the eagle's eye, the raven's caw, the wind's whispers. The thing they hold, just watching over you.
As you see, people who are different, no matter good or bad, still have spirits watching over them.
Next, we're going to hear from Julio Rodriguez, a student in the Roseland University Prep.
My name is Julio Rodriguez. I come from Roseland University Prep. I'm 16. I'm a junior there. So I began working on poetry aloud in my freshman year, and I've been enjoying it so much that I really get into the poems and the recitation parts and everything. I get really excited when my teachers tell me that I'm doing such a good job, and that influences me to keep reading poetry and learning more about the program, which is really good for me and for my teachers in my school. Today, my first poem is going to be Hero by Paul Engel. And I really like the tone and the main message of the entire poem. I can sometimes relate to it in many parts of the poem, and I really like the language and the words and the way the poet just describes each and every part of his main message. Hero by Paul Engel. I have heard the horn of Roland goldly screaming in the petty Pyrenees of the inner ear, and seen the frightful Saracens of fear pour from the passes, fought them, brave and dreaming, but waked and heard my own voice tinly screaming in the world and whirling valleys of the ear, and beat the savage bed back in my fear, and crawled unheroed down those cliffs of dreaming. I have ridden with Hannibal in the mountain dusk, watching the drivers yell the doom and gray elephants over the trumpeting Alps, gone gay with snow, vivid on peaks, on the ivory tusk, but waked and found myself in the vivid dusk, plunging the deep and icy floor, gone gray with bellowing shapes of morning, and the gay sunshaft through me like an ivory tusk. I have smiled on the platform, hearing without shame the crowd scream out my praise. I, the new star, handsome, disparaging my bloody scar, yet turning its curve to the light when they call my name. But waked, and the empty windows sneered my name. The sky bled, drop by golden drop. Each star, the curved moon, glittered like a sickle scar. The night wind called with its gentle voices. Shame. I have climbed the secret balcony on the floor, lain with the lady, drunk the passionate wine, found beneath the green, lewd, smelling vine. Love opened to me like a waiting door, but waked to delirious shadows on the door, found while my stomach staggered with sour wine. Green drunkenness creeps on me like a vine, and I puked my passion on the bathroom floor. I have run with Boone and watched the Indian pillage the log house, fought, erring leg, and hobbled over the painful ground while the warrior gobbled wild turkey cry, but escaped to save the village. But waked and walked the city, vicious village, fought through the traffic where the wild horn gobbled, bruised on the bumper, turned toward home, hobbled back myself, the house, my neighbor's pillage. I have lain in bed and felt my body taken, like water utterly possessing sand, surrounding, seething, soothing, as a hand comforts and clasps the hand that it has shaken, but waked, and found that I was wholly shaken by you. As the waves surround and seethes the sand, that your whole body was a reaching hand, and my whole body the hand that yours had taken.
You've been listening to students and poet teachers from California Poets in the Schools. That program is going to have a celebration of 45 years. That will take place at the Central Library in Santa Rosa this coming Saturday, April 17th, from 3 to 5 in the afternoon. It's a wonderful opportunity for you to come and meet some of the poets. And, of course, there are many events going on in the county around the project Sonoma County Reads. There are discussions of Tom Sawyer taking place in every single one of the county libraries. And if you go to the website, Sonoma County Reads, you'll see the complete calendar. One of the events that particularly got my attention was a performance of the Tom Sawyer Ballet, which will take place in Cotati at the Ballet Khalifa Studio on Friday, May 14th and Saturday, May 15th. So check that one out. Here at KRCB Television, we're going to be presenting the Ken Burns film on Mark Twain, a superb film all about Mark Twain. That will be on Tuesday, April 27th at 9 o'clock in the evening and Tuesday, May 4th at 9. So don't miss those programs on the adventures of Tom Sawyer. Thanks to Phyllis Meshlin for bringing in her young poets. Thanks to Jonah Raskin for coming in to talk about Mark Twain. And thanks to Suzanne Lang, the producer of the program. I hope you'll join us again next month on Novel Idea on May 12th, when my guest will be Enchi Min, talking about her new book, Pearl of China. A young woman from China talks about Pearl Buck. So thanks for tuning in tonight. We'll see you next time. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you won't mind if I smoke. I believe there's some commandment against smoking. during insurrections of this dignified nature, but I'm working to get it removed. Mind you, I have no objection to abstinence, so long as it does not harm anybody. I practice it myself on occasion. I make it a rule never to smoke when asleep. Not that I care for moderation myself, I do it as an example to others. And to prove that I'm not a slave to the habit. I can give it up whenever I want to. I've done it 1,000 times. First time I gave it up was when I was a boy, about 10 or 11. They told me that I would shorten my life 10 years by smoking, so I got scared and gave it up one day for 2 or 3 hours. Then I finally decided the decade wouldn't be worth living without any smoking in it, so that's the end of that. Well, then another time I gave it up on the advice of my doctor. I'd been confined to my bed for several days with the lumbago. And the doctor finally said to me, look here, my remedies haven't got a chance. Consider what they have to fight besides the lumbago. You smoke extravagantly. You eat all manner of things that don't agree with each other's company. You drink 2 hard scotches every night, don't you? I said, yes, I do, but I only drink them as a preventative of toothache. I've never had the toothache. I don't ever intend to have it. Well, he said, that's all right, but we can't make any progress that way. You've got to moderate those things. I said, I can't do it, doctor. He said, why can't you? Why? I said, because I lack the willpower. I can cut them off entirely, but I can't moderate them. Well, he said that would answer, so I cut off all those things for 2 days and 2 nights. At the end of that time, the lumbago was discouraged and left me. I was a well man again. So I gave thanks and took to these delicacies again. Well, then I had occasion to recommend this remedy to an elderly lady friend of mine. She'd gone down and down to the point where medicines no longer had any helpful effect on her. I told her I could cure her in a week. I said she must give up smoking and drinking and eating and swearing. And by the end of the week, she'd be on her feet. Why, she said she couldn't give up smoking and drinking and swearing because she'd never done any of those things. So there it was. She'd neglected her habits. It was a sinking ship with no freight to throw overboard. Why, just 1 or 2 little bad habits would have saved her. But she was just a moral pauper.